Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Pulitzer Prize winner Viet Thanh Nguyen discusses his new memoir, A Man of Two Faces, with writer Vu Tran. The following conversation originally took place October 23rd, 2023, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Carrie Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. And with that said, I'm going to introduce our guests tonight. In A Man of Two Faces, Pulitzer Prize winner Viet Thanh Nguyen rewinds the film of his own life with insight, humor, formal invention, and lyricism. Born in Vietnam and raised in America, Viet is the author of The Committed, which continues the story of The Sympathizer, which was awarded the 2016 Pulitzer Prize in Fiction, alongside seven other prizers. He is also the author of the short story collection The Refugees, and the nonfiction book Nothing Ever Dies, a finalist for the National Book Award, and he's the editor and anthology of refugee writing The Displaced. He is the Errol Arnold Professor of English and American Studies of Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, and a recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim and MacArthur Foundations. He is joined by University of Chicago Professor Vu Tran, author of Dragonfish, a New York Times notable book, and a San Francisco Chronicle Best Book of the Year, as well as the forthcoming novel, Your Origins, and a good friend of the museum, Vu Tran. Please help me in welcoming them both.
Thanks so much for that introduction, Carrie, and good evening, Chicago. So great to be back here with all of you. You should give your own city some applause, I think. That'd be great. Yeah. And especially at the American Writers Museum, such a pleasure to be back here as well. I think the last time I was back in this specific location was actually with Vu when we were talking about the book, The Displaced, Refugee Writers on Refugee Lives. He's a refugee, I'm a refugee. Maybe that'll come up tonight in the conversation. But
we are indeed.
Yeah, I've known you for a while, but you know, I first heard about Vu when he applied for my creative writing PhD program at USC. And we all thought, oh my God, we have to get this guy. He's so talented. You didn't take our offer. No, you went to UNLV instead. Yeah. So all worked out, obviously.
Biggest regret. I liked poker too much.
Wow, you're going to write a book about that someday. Yeah. Sometimes I start off with like long comments and so on, but we know each other, so we're just going to have a conversation.
Yeah, it was a good casual conversation. First of all, it's good to see you. It's actually, I haven't seen you since before COVID.
Yeah.
So, at some point, I do want to let people know you're going to read briefly from the book, and it's about your mother, and it's a great passage. Perhaps we can offer some context first, and lead to that, if that's okay. Yeah. Give everybody something to look forward to as well, because I'd like to begin with form. And by the way, I have a lot of, I was really looking forward to this conversation because I feel like I finally have the justification to pry into your life a little bit. but let's begin with form as genre and also form, in the writing itself. You know, first of all, the subtitle of A Man of Two Faces is a memoir, a history, a memorial. Now, I think a lot of people are just kind of simply calling it a memoir. Maybe just out of because it's easier, but I have a sense that that's insufficient for you to just call it a memoir, right? Am I right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And like you said, when you write a memoir, you give people license to pry into your life. It'd be really weird to write a memoir and then show up and say, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about my life. But in fact, I think for most of my life as a writer, I didn't want to talk about my life. I thought my life was actually really, really boring. And that the life of my parents was really interesting, and we'll talk about that they were refugees who lived these extraordinary lives. And yet, what happened was that during the pandemic, I had to do something. And so what I did was I opened up an archive and I discovered an essay, and that compelled me to write this book. And so in a sense, it took me 2 years to write this book during the pandemic. And in another sense, it took me 32 years to write this book, because that essay was from 32 years ago. The essay was, I wrote it when I was an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, and I took a class with Maxine Hong Kingston, whom hopefully many of you know, the author of The Woman Warrior and many other books. And at the time in the early 90s, The Woman Warrior was reputed to be the most popular book on college campuses.
I read most it in college.
You did, right? I was 19 years old, so what did I care? So I got admitted into her class of about 14 students, and I sat about as far away from Maxine as the front row. And every day, I would fall asleep. You know, and Maxine has told me to my face that I was the worst student in her class. Everyone else got an A, and I got a B+, otherwise known as an Asian F.
That's pretty good for falling asleep.
Yeah, not bad, right?
B+ is pretty good for falling asleep.
But you know, if you're Asian, you know it's a cut.
Yeah, it's terrible.
You know it's a cut. Anyway, at the end of the semester, she writes everybody a letter. And in my letter, she says, you should really seek counseling.
And you're alienated.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
But I said, I thought I was perfectly normal. You know, my college roommate, Wilson, is in the audience right now. And my excuse was Wilson Chen, and I were college activists. So I was out there every night, up late, doing my political stuff and everything. And that's why I was falling asleep in class. I was totally normal. Of course, I got married, and then my wife said, you are not normal. And I said, really? And so I think what Maxine saw in the essay was that I was a disturbed young person, and I just didn't get it. And the reason why she thought so was because that essay was about my mother being committed to a psychiatric facility. And obviously, very, very hard essay for me to write. And so I put that essay away for 30 years, and then when I opened up the archive, I reread the essay. And for those 30 years, what I thought was my mother had gone to the psychiatric facility when I was a little boy, because that's how I felt, small and terrified. And then I reread the essay and I realized she had gone to the psychiatric facility when I was 18, and I'd written about it a year later. And so my memory, even as a young adult and a grown man, had deceived me, tricked me, and I don't think that was unusual. And that was my first clue that this was something I should be writing about. But also, you brought up the question of form. It was then the question of how should I write about this? And I wasn't interested in writing the conventional memoir. I mean, for me, the conventional memoir is very much about you as an individual. And I grew up feeling, again, that my parents were the people that really mattered. Mm-hmm. And in order to make sense of them and me, it couldn't just be a memoir about us. It had to be, from my understanding, how we were shaped by the history of contemporary Vietnam and by the history of the entirety of the United States. And then finally, a memorial to my mother as well.
Well, see, that's, I'm curious about this because my kind of, you know, this is just presumption on my part, but I can't help but see a certain dramatic arc in your writing life, which of course responds with your life. And, you know, that you've always had this very specific story or question or struggle that you felt a desperate need to get out. And initially, criticism, you know, theory, scholarship, opened a door for that expression, or at least part of it. And then fiction opened up another very different door, which seems to be the one you're always most keen on unlocking, right? And then suddenly, memoir opened up a door you never really wanted at all, or thought you didn't want at all. But it's become this unexpectedly fruitful, you know, vehicle of expression. So, and not that any of these genres are exhaustible for you, or that there won't be other, you know, new doors in the future. But can you speak to this? I mean, it seems like part of the story or question or whatever you want to call it that you've been wanting to get out, that this essay about your mother is part of it. But if you had to say what that specific story, question, whatever it is, was that you've been trying to find these different forms to express, how would you describe it?
Yeah, that's a great question, you know, because I think, you know, when I started off, I thought, when I was young, when I was like in the third grade, I thought, I want to be a writer.
Fiction writer.
No, I wanted to be a writer. Okay, so what happened was in the third grade, when I was 8 years old, you know, my teacher said, your project is to write and draw your own book. You know, and so I wrote and drew my own book, and that book was Lester the Cat. Lester was an urban cat, stricken with ennui. Bored with city life, he fled to the countryside. There, in a hay-strewn barn, he found love with a country cat. And when you're 8 years old, genres don't matter. I didn't care. I was a writer, you know. And then the San Jose Public Library gave me an award for that book.
Nice.
And that was my first taste of literary fame. And so I'm forever grateful to the San Jose Public Library for setting me on the path to over 30 years of misery in trying to become a writer. But, you know, I think when I, when you're a kid, you don't have boundaries. You don't have a sense of genres or anything. It's just writing. It's just art. And that's really wonderful. And then as I got older, it was about genres. You know, I'm going to become a fiction writer. I'm going to become a critic and so on. But in the end, I think by now I've decided that I'm just a writer. And the writers I really admire oftentimes are the writers who I can't tell how to define them. W.G. Zabel, the German writer, for example, huge influence on me. When I read his fiction and nonfiction, I can't tell the difference, which is fiction and nonfiction. He's a writer, he was a writer, obsessed with historical questions about World War II, genocide, Holocaust, forgetting, the nation. And so many of those are my concerns as well. So I think to answer your question, you're absolutely right. There are these obsessions and themes that I have that I've been developed, that I've been working with over time, and they become ever more clear to me the more I've written about them, the more I've tried different forms to deal with them. So my criticism initially was very much about Asian American literature because, you know, Wilson is a witness to this. We both became radicalized at the University of Communists at Berkeley. You know, we both became radical Asian Americans and, you know, we were both English majors, and I became convinced that Asian American literature was my salvation and my route to liberation, right? And it still is in a lot of ways, but as I investigated these questions of what shaped me in terms of history and writing, the more I would realize that things like being Asian American were so crucial, but also so limited in so many ways. And so it's been a perpetual quest to understand who I am relative to my family and the secrets and the things we never told each other. And then my relationship to my country, the United States, and the secrets and the deceptions that we have as Americans that I think are fundamental to our country. And so it's been a lifelong project to try to figure out the right forms that would allow me to understand myself, my family, and my country ever better.
Yeah. And actually, Zabel is a good example of this. He's a fantastic writer who's inspired me a great deal. But with writers like him and writers like you, there is a feeling when you do kind of have a fluidity of form, you know, between genres and everything, there's a sense that there's a kind of impatience with form as well, right? A kind of dissatisfaction with what form and tradition is providing you to tell your story. So it's like, you know, when you open up this book, the things that you will immediately see are, you know, for me, I see impatience, you know, or markers of impatience with the limitations of form. You know, Man with Two Faces, you play a lot with a typical form of a memoir or autobiography. You know, the book begins in first person, then moves into second person for most of the book until returning to the end. Certain passages of text are isolated and manipulated on the page to mimic, you know, poetic form. Some text is even enlarged. America is capitalized with a trademark symbol. The thing I love are a lot of the jokes, often these kind of satirical asides that it's like you're appropriating the tonal improvisational rhythms of stand-up comedy. So as a way of speaking to these specific choices, I mean, let me ask you, what aspects of the traditional form of memoir felt either insufficient or contradictory to your goals?
All right, I can answer that question. You know, when a memoir is supposed to elicit something from you as a writer, and readers often expect something from memoir, and I think typically it's trauma. You know, I mean, I wish, you know, none of you feel the need to write a memoir, because if you do, something terrible probably happened somewhere in your past. And so when we pick up a memoir, there's a pact. We're going to find out some secret, something terrible, et cetera. But we also think it's very private. It's a private secret that we're going to get, okay? And especially then, if you happen to be a so-called minority in this society, your private secret is often linked to a particular kind of historical trauma. But as our friend, the poet Bao Phi, has said in one of his poems, if you're Vietnamese, you're only allowed one trauma, the Vietnam War. You're not allowed to speak about anything else. And if you deviate from that, people get upset. They're like, how dare you connect the Vietnam War to some other war, or the Vietnam War to Hurricane Katrina, and so on. And that's true for all so-called minorities in this country. We're all allowed one grief, one trauma. We're experts on that one thing, but we're not supposed to be experts on the country. So in the book, I say, I'm not allowed to be the great American novelist, maybe because I don't have the talent, but I'm also not allowed to be the great American novelist because that's what white men do. Mm. White men get to write about the entire country. I'm the not so great American novelist, and I'm proud to hold on to that title. Because, again, we're only expected to write about our little bit. And when I write about the Vietnam War, or about the Vietnam War as trauma, as grief, and so on, I write about it not because I'm only a Vietnamese person writing about the refugee experience. I do, but I also write about the entirety of the American experience as well. And I'm not supposed to do that. And just to give you one example, you know, there was that documentary, Last Days of Saigon, and it profiled a bunch of Vietnamese people who lived through the fall of Saigon, and they were asked to speak about their eyewitness experience. What did you see on that day? But Americans who were interviewed, and everybody from the embassy guard to Henry Kissinger, and Henry Kissinger was asked, what is the geopolitical situation of Indochina? The Vietnamese people, for whom this is our country and our war, we were never asked, what is your take on the geopolitics of your own war and your own country, right? And I think that's what I resist with a form of the ethnic memoir. And the ethnic memoir, I feel, is what is given to us as so-called ethnic people. And I didn't want to write the ethnic memoir. And you all know what that is. I'm sure you've all read at least one. And the ethnic memoir is, you begin at the beginning, something horrible happened in your homeland to your parents or your grandparents, something horrible happened to them here because we know we have racism in the United States. But then look at you, you're now a writer, so you've achieved the American dream. Congratulations. I can tell I'm very upset about all this. And I do resist that. I resent that imposition of form on me, because it's not just form. It's an imposition of an entire ideological expectation of who we are as people and what we're allowed to say and how we're allowed to say it. So this book, as Vu described it, does blow up all kinds of things. And he makes it sound very intimidating, like a Samuel Beckett
play.
Please say it.
It's very readable.
It's very readable. Yeah. Okay. Now, I will end with this one example from children's literature, which I've mentioned already. So I became a father, and you know, I started reading children's literature with my son after 30 years of not reading. And I'll give you one example of a book that he loves, or a series, by Dav Pilkey called Dog Man. Dog Man is about a super cop who has the body of a heroic police officer.
Wait, super cop?
He's called a super cop.
Super cop.
And he has the body of a heroic buffed police officer, but the head of a dog. I'm not going to tell you how that happens. And he has all these adventures, you know, against Petey the cat, and all kinds of things happen in this book that adults would be like, I don't get it. Why do you have a flipperama in here? Why do you have a super cop? How can a cop have a head of a dog? You know what? Kids don't ask any of these questions. They just love the book with titles like Fetch 22 and For Whom the Ball Rolls. You know? It's awesome. You can read this. You don't need a kid as an excuse. And my point is, kids don't have any boundaries, genres, expectations. They go with the flow. They go with the invention. They don't ask any questions as long as it works for them. And as I was writing this book, I just gave in to the inner child in a very good way. You know, because again, I think it is important that as adults and as writers, we know genres, rules, conventions, and so on. But then we've lost something about the childlike capacity to just create, and that I've absorbed from children's literature.
Yeah,
and
but play is underrated, right?
Play
because
is totally underrated.
We always have to kind of like hone in on what is the goal, and sometimes you know you don't know the goal unless you play, right? Mm-hmm. But if there are kind of like you know aspects of the memoir that are insufficient, what needs did you find that it you know fulfilled for you that you could not have fulfilled in say a novel or especially in a work of criticism?
Yeah. Well, I think that there is something about the memoir that is really compelling after everything I've said about it, which is that in order to write that private secret, you do have to go dig deep. Mm-hmm. Or as my other writing teacher, Bharati Mukherjee, told me when she was reading my short stories, which she also gave a B+ to, so I guess there's a pattern, you know, but she said, you don't cut to the bone in these stories. And I was like 19 or 20. I was like, how do I do that? How do I cut to the bone? And, you know, that's a matter of art and discipline and so on. Yeah. You learn the craft and the tools and the techniques and all that. But it's also, I think, for me, it still is a matter of being able to confront my emotional vulnerability and everything inside of me that terrified me so much that I had to deceive myself. And writing a memoir, a good one, I think, is about cutting to the bone. It is about using whatever tools you might have outside of a knife to look so deep inside of you into places that terrify you. And that's why, you know, it's so hard actually to write a powerful memoir. And so I think this book does do that, but I don't let you have that experience until the last third of the book. Yeah. I think, again, the lure of the memoir is we want it right away. We want you to immediately tell us whatever that secret is. And then, you know, we want to cry. We want to have that catharsis. And I never forgot Richard Wright. You know, he'd become successful with a first book called Uncle Tom's Children about black sharecroppers. And he recounts later on about how at an event, these white readers came up to him and said, "We cried so much reading Uncle Tom's Children." And Richard Wright thought, "I don't want you to cry. I want you to get mad." Mm. And so then he wrote Native Son.
Yeah.
Native Son, right? And so that's what I wanted to do in this book. You know, I'm still angry. So the first 2/3 is me being angry.
I can tell.
And then I get sad in the last third of the book. But you have to earn the right to cry for me.
Well, let's segue into that and into you reading a passage. But, you know, I want to kind of frame it a bit with this, your use of the second person, which is, I think, one of the more interesting choices in the book. I actually am using second person in my novel a little bit, right? And I've always found that in the works of second person that I find most compelling are the ones where the second person is used almost as a kind of, it's almost like the narrator talking to themselves. It's, in many ways, I feel it's even more intimate and honest, potentially, than the first person, the second person. You're obviously not writing a novel here, but in your book, there is that sense that at some, I mean, you literally talk to yourself at one point. And actually, let me read this. There's a point on around 270, 280 where you write, "It is the fall of 2003, Ma is healthy. Neither of you know that in 2 years, nothing will be the same ever again for her or you or me." Now, up to this point, after the first person section, everything has been in second person, and suddenly the me returns, the I me returns. And this feels to me like you finally making your reasons for the title literal, that the I is one face and that the you is another face. I mean, is this what you intended? And can you talk about this?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've talked often about how when I was growing up in the United States as a young refugee in the 70s and 80s, I felt very divided. And I think that's a very common immigrant, refugee, so-called minority or colonized experience. You feel divided. And in my case, it was because I grew up as an American, but in this very Vietnamese household. So I felt like I was an American spying on my Vietnamese parents and my Vietnamese community. And then I would step out into the rest of the American world and I would feel like a Vietnamese spying on these Americans. And again, very common double consciousness experience you'll find everywhere in the writings of people of color in the colonized. But not interesting for me, personally, because no one wants to read about Viet's life. Like I said, I thought it was boring. So
I'm sorry. It's not interesting because it's about you. Is that what you're saying?
Because I thought I was uninteresting.
Okay.
You know, because I thought that everything that had happened to me and to my family was normal.
Okay.
Because I was growing up going to the San Jose Public Library, reading all these works of great canonical value of the English Anglo-American tradition and everything. And I was like, who cares about these Vietnamese refugees like us? You know, who cares that my parents got shot in their store on Christmas Eve? Who cares that someone broke into our house and put a gun into all of our faces? Who cares what my mother went through? To me, that was all normal. You know, because I grew up among Vietnamese refugees and this kind of stuff happened to everybody. To be a refugee in this country, by definition, something horrible happened to you. And I can count on the fingers of one hand probably the number of Vietnamese refugees I've met who had a great experience coming to this country, right? So for us, it was normal to be traumatized. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, and you know, my experience was we never talked about the trauma. You know, we never talked about it because we just had to move forward. If we looked back, we risked destruction because we had to forget and we had to move on. And then we took it out on each other, either deliberately or inadvertently, because we never worked through what it is that had happened to us and what it is that we did. So I thought it was completely boring. And so then I put all these feelings into, when I became a novelist, into the sympathizer. And, you know, he is a very dramatic person, but he's also me in the emotional sense of being a man of two faces. Yeah. And so when it came time to write this book, my first lever into myself was to pretend that I wasn't me writing this book, that I was a sympathizer writing to me. And the you is me, but it's also me interrogating myself. If you read The Sympathizer, he's deeply interrogated by the end of the book. And I thought, well, if I'm going to subject him to that so that he can pry open the secret that even he does not know and that I did not know about him when I started writing this book, I would reverse it and turn it upon myself and see what would be uncovered if I interrogated myself. And the last thing about the you as that makes it very powerful is that, yes, when you say you in the second person, oftentimes you're addressing yourself, but there's a moment in second person narratives, typically, when there's a little bit of a blending between the you that is yourself and the you that could be you who's reading the book. And that's part of the brilliance of, I think, the second person that makes it powerful. You know, sometimes there's a slippage, right? And then finally, in the passage that you read, I mean, I'm talking to you, my mother, but you, me, myself as well.
It's so multidirectional.
Multidirectional, but it's also singular and collective.
Yeah.
And like, as I was saying, the power of memoir from colonized people and people of color and women oftentimes is that they transgress against the singularity of the first person memoir form. They want to talk about what it means to be a part of a family, a community, a collectivity. And so the singular first person oftentimes is just so limiting.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, that notion of being a spy, I think is really fascinating, especially an unintentional spy, right? Which you feel that you've been in different ways in your life, and one of those is on your parents and on your mother in a way. And maybe you could read that a passage for us.
Yeah. I will say, you know, that the experience of being a spy is something that many writers feel too.
Yeah.
You know, like we're always, I don't know about you, but I'm always spying on people. I'm always like, you know, whenever I'm having a conversation with you, I'm like, oh gosh, what can I learn and observe from this person?
We don't want to make this sound creepy, but yeah. I mean, we're just observant.
We're just observant.
Just very observant. Yeah.
And so you never know, a fragment of you might appear in one of my books one day. All right. Ma was born in 1937. As Nguyen Thi Bai, a poor girl in a poor northern Vietnamese village. She dies in 2018 as Linda Kim Nguyen, American citizen, traveler of a life both ordinary and epic. At 17, she married and became a refugee for the first time. At 17, I almost did not graduate from high school because I nearly failed pre-calculus. At 38, a mother of two biological sons and one adopted daughter, Ma became a refugee for the second time, her sequel starting in an alien country. At 38, I, with no children, struggled with writing a short story about Ma. Ma's first name is Bai. Giving children numbers as names was common in rural Vietnam. Families often had so many children. Some would not survive. Why give a girl a real name? As a girl, the seventh child, she deserved no more. Ma hated this birth name. In her last decades, she wanted to be called by her American name, Linda. But both her names feel alien on my tongue. I never called her by her name, only Ma as a child. Ma, as an adult. Her refugee path shaped even what I called her. Northerners say Ma, Southerners say Ma, and I, as always, am somewhere in between. Most Americans who met Ma probably only saw her mortal, unextraordinary coil. If they knew anything about her, they might know she had been a shopkeeper, businesswoman, refugee. If they knew nothing about her, she was another Asian woman who did not speak good English. Ma, or Ma, never wanted to mention how she received only a grade school education. I'm telling on her, and yet she should be told on, even if it is not my secret to tell. Look at what Ma accomplished with just a grade school education. Overcoming everything, almost everything, except her mind. Defeated, like so many heroes, not by others, but by herself. A hero, but not a soldier. People like Ma, who will not be remembered by history, are also a part of history, drafted as reluctant players in horrific wars. Unlike soldiers, these civilians, many of them women and children, never get the recognition they deserve. Some endure more terror, see more horror, than some soldiers. And the wars of the 20th century, including the ones in Vietnam, killed far more civilians than soldiers. Civilian stories can be war stories too. Perhaps what happened to my mother was simply her body and mind's fate. But history and war took their turns hammering Ma, unnerving her, breaking her. My mother, child of colonization and war. Me, grandchild of colonization and war. Also the child of Ba Ma who chose each other. For all that Ma was lost to us for so many years, my father's love was not lost to her. She saw this reality from the orbit of her surreality. I know because the last words Ma says on her hospital bed in the family room before she says the Lord's Prayer with my father are for my father, to my father. Am Yêu Anh. This I will translate, even if the translation is not enough. I love you. After the Lord's Prayer, silence. My brother, the doctor, gives Ma morphine while my sister-in-law, the doctor, watches. Ma's eyes are long closed. Her breathing slows. I lean close to tell Ma in Vietnamese that I love her. She lived a good life, a life of hard work and sacrifice, a heroic life. A life that demanded so much strength, devotion, and love. I don't know where Ma found those qualities, but I am the beneficiary. These words, this faith in her, this betrayal of her, are the outcome. Ma's eyes do not open. She gives no sign of hearing. Her breathing finally stops. It is midnight. Her journey on this earth, complete. My mother is mine, and my mother is also other to me. My brother makes a phone call. In an hour, a courteous stranger who might be Filipino arrives with a gurney, fills out a form, takes away my mother, leaves the empty hospital bed in the family room, and drives my mother into the night. I remember Ma loved me. Everything else, I can forget.
That's a beautiful passage. Has it become easier for you to say that? I know you actually say, with your dad, you can say, I love you, and even he can say it now. But is it, I mean, I still find it hard.
To say I love you?
We only started doing this, like, just my dad about 20 years ago. I'm sorry, 15 years ago.
That's not that bad, actually.
It's actually, But with my mom, no. Yeah. No, not yet.
Yeah. You know, I realized I had a problem when I was in my teens, and people started to say, not my parents, we never said I love you or anything, but I never said I love you to my parents either, so it goes both ways, right? But I remember in my teens, people started to say I love you to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, why? I couldn't say it back. Yeah. I mean, I literally froze. I was like, I can't do it. I can't bring myself to say these words. And partly because I didn't feel it. I thought I didn't feel it. And I know because I have these diaries that I kept from high school and early college, which I will burn very, very soon. but in it, I talk about myself and I say, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Why can't you feel anything? And in the opening of the book, I recount an incident where I'm 9 years old, Christmas Eve. I'm home with my brother, who's 15 or 16. I'm watching cartoons, waiting for my parents to come home. And the phone rings, and my brother picks it up, and he talks, and he comes back, and he says, Mom and Dad have been shot. I couldn't say anything.
Yeah.
My brother said, what's wrong with you? And he's crying. Why aren't you crying? So that's what I mean. Like, I think that sometimes, you know, these stories of colonization and war are from our parents' generation. When we listen to them, they're horrifying. They're about war and famine and death and all these kinds of terrible things. But then I think about how refugee experience and war experience also are these minor, small moments like that too. And when you're, I don't find myself to be a witness to history. I find myself to be a witness to my parents and what they went through and about how they were shot. And then like a day or two later, they were back at work because it was only flesh wounds. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't work, what was going to happen? Someone had to go to work. Someone had to make the money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what was interesting is I couldn't say I love you. I felt totally numb. And then I became a professor and an academic. And being numb is very good for being an academic. Very, very good.
We're quite good at that.
We're very good. And then I would. And then I became a speaker and I would go on the road after my novel, first novel. And then one time I was in front of this audience and I talked about that. You know, I talked about my parents and the grocery store, which I hadn't talked about for a while. And I was overcome by emotion. And that never happened to me. I was like, what does this mean? I'm being subverted by something within myself, these feelings that I never acknowledged, never knew about, and I had suppressed in order to survive. And becoming a writer, I think, has been for me a journey into form and experiment and all these artistic questions, but it's also been a journey into, again, cutting to the bone and letting these emotions come out and being willing to talk about these things in front of you and being learning how to say I love you to the people who matter to me, you know? And with my dad, you know, with my mom and my dad, we were both able to say it eventually. And my brother and I are very proud that we wore my father down. So now he willingly says, I love you all the time to his grandkids and to us. And I feel like that is a huge accomplishment. You know, it's not a small thing to be able to say, I love you. And we have a friend or a Vietnamese American writing colleague, Lac Su, whose book is I Love Yous Are for White People. And whenever I mention that title, the white people will say, no, we can't say I love you either. You know, like we come from hardy German stock or some kind of ethnic European stock, and we can't say I love you either. So it's not just Vietnamese people. But yeah, I think that so for me, all these questions of art and emotion are wrapped up in each other. And being able to say I love you to my children on a daily basis, even now when they flinch from me when I say it, I'm thinking this is good for you. You'll remember this. You'll appreciate this one day.
But you know, but you still frame it. You know, after this passage, I can ask you so many questions because I think so much of the book's emotional and intellectual life comes out of that passage. I think, or is embodied in that passage. You know, one of the things, like 10 pages later, you ask the question. Is this honesty or betrayal? Sometimes telling the secret is both. There is a sense that, you know, on describing some of the difficulties that your mother went to, had, and but also just your own feelings about her, just writing about her at all feels like a betrayal. But you distinguish it between, you know, you talk about, you know, telling the secret, you know, but you distinguish between private secrets and open secrets, that the private secrets are the kinds of things that this kind of book wants or requires, or the readers of this kind of book want, whereas we kind of stay blind to the open secrets, which is more kind of, I mean, how would you define that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you read The Woman Warrior, or you just read the first two lines of the book, Maxine on Kingston begins that book by saying, in the voice of her narrator, "You must not tell anyone, my mother told me, what I'm about to tell you." And then, of course, the whole book is about her telling everything that she's not supposed to say. And it's an act of love, and it's an act of betrayal, and it's an act of memoir, and that to me, those opening two lines summarizes everything that is at the heart of the project of a memoir to me. Unless you're willing to do this, unless you're willing to say what must not be told, which often involves either betraying yourself at the very least, or betraying people who are close to you, your memoir may not be worth very much, right? In an emotional sense. But that's what readers want. They want that. They want that betrayal of the private secret. And like I said, I'm going to give it to you. I'm going to give it to you. But only after you've been through everything else in this book, which is about the open secrets. Mm-hmm. And the open secrets for me, the ones that concern me, are the open secrets of our country. You know, what is it that everybody knows, but we are not allowed to say? Or we're not encouraged to say? Or we're discouraged from saying? So for me, I'll give you my personal narrative. You know, I came to this country at 4 years of age as a refugee. And when you're a refugee coming to this country, or an immigrant, your life story can be told as long as it affirms the American dream, right? Welcome to our country. We rescued you. But let's not talk about how we wouldn't have needed to rescue you if we hadn't bombed you in the first place. You're not supposed to talk about the second part. And I came to this country as a refugee, and we arrived in Pennsylvania, and our first destination was Fort Indian Town Gap, a military base with a refugee camp. And I have to confess, for 40 years, I never thought twice about why the fort was called Indian Town Gap. And of course, it's called Indian Town Gap because white settlers built it to defend themselves or to wage war against the indigenous peoples, the Susquehannock or the Conestoga, most of whom had been wiped out by 1700. But the remaining, most of the remainder were massacred by a white vigilante group called the Paxton Boys. Well, we left the refugee camp, and my parents bought a house, the first house they ever bought in the United States. And last year, my brother found the deed to the property, and my parents bought their first house in Harrisburg in Lower Paxton Township, where the Paxton Boys are from. So what does it mean to come as a refugee to this country, to achieve the American dream, to become citizens, to be owners, to claim this country, unless it also means claiming everything about this country, including indigenous land and our living on it? And it's an incredible contradiction that most refugees and immigrants do not acknowledge. And Americans, of course, greatly struggle acknowledging it because it completely disrupts everything we know about the American dream, which is why I put America in capital letters with trademark and the American dream in capital letters with trademark symbol, because I don't want people to just say America and American dream without thinking twice, because we never think twice when we say America or the American dream. And that is the power of America and the American dream, to get us to say the American dream without realizing that it is a euphemism for settler colonialism, for genocide, for enslavement, for war, for appropriation. These are the open secrets of our country, which at least half the country refuses to acknowledge. And so when I talk about honesty and betrayal in that larger or the collective and communal sense of us as Americans, I mean that this act of honesty on the part of those of us who want to talk about these open secrets of our country are construed as acts of betrayal by people who don't want those things to be talked about. Just as betraying the private secrets of your family is also a treacherous territory to wander into.
Let me ask you this question, because at one point, you know, you had this funny bit where you give like the five steps to writing an immigrant saga for the American and Western marketplace. And basically the steps are what you should not do. That's the implication. And one of them is, you know, describe generational conflict as a result of personal differences, family tension, cultural conflict, and not the direct intimate consequence of colonization. I should just finish it with the resulting upheaval of millions, events that America has often instigated. You return to that many pages later with a more kind of focused question. So how do you separate yourself and your memories from history? And I know that you're not obviously saying that you know, the historical side of it is the only way to explain, say, a personal conflict, right? But I do wonder what you think of, do we risk explaining too much of our personal conflict through the lens of larger social, culture, and historical forces? You and I both agree that those forces are quite consequential. But how do we balance our view of that cause and effect of personal experience? In other words, do we risk not seeing the trees for the forest? Mm-hmm. It's just curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, that's why the book is partly about the country and about our history, and then partly it's about my mother, and you know, the enduring mystery of my mother's life and death to me is that I don't know what caused her to go to psychiatric facilities three times in her life. 1975, she comes to this country. I don't remember this. My brother tells me, well, Ma went to the psychiatric facility because her own mother had died in Vietnam, and she wasn't there for that. And then she came back, and then she was fine for 16, 17 years, and she went again to the psychiatric facility. Why? Well, was it because, as my parents said, if you date that girl, your mom is going to have a heart attack? That's what they told me, and I dated that girl.
Yeah.
And then my mom went to the psychiatric facility. Yeah. That really screwed me up. And then doing the math in my head. 14 years later, she goes to a psychiatric facility and, you know, never recovers. So for 13 years, I mean, she's not in the psychiatric facility, but, you know, she's at home being taken care of by my 70-plus-year-old father. So what happened? Is it some fault inside of her body, her mind? Or is it history and all these causes that I've been discussing? I will never know. And again, for so many of us who are not, you know, so many people who've been through war and trauma and colonization and the refugee experience, we will never know why people have been messed up. You know, because some people go through these things, like my father, my brother, and myself, and we come out on the other side and we're fine, or we seem to be fine, or at least we're functional. Okay. I don't know if my wife says I'm not. Like, I don't know. But I mean, on the surface, I'm functional. But then other people, like my mother, don't. And you can look at the same thing with soldiers. Some of them go through these horrific experiences. Some come out seemingly fine, and some are devastated. We don't know. And that's the mystery. And that's why I think you're right. You know, there is a forest and the trees. And in this book, I'm trying to look at both.
Yeah.
And not trying to come to a conclusion, because I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's why the mystery stays with me, because I can't answer the question.
Yeah. You say that out loud. Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of great questions here. But this is to this point. In addition to the essay, do you think the death of your mother also unleashed a desire to write this book?
My mother died in 2018, and I don't know if it unleashed a desire in as much as it removed a barrier.
Okay,
because when you're betraying people, it's better when they're not around to hear it. And so I think, I've talked to so many people who said, I really want to write my family story, my life story, whatever, but I'm afraid to do it because obviously it involves other people. And that's a real human ethical concern. If you didn't feel that concern, you're probably a good writer. You know, I'm like, you're like, I don't care, I'm just going to write about whatever. But it's a real human and ethical thing. And so, yes, I think my mother passing away removed a huge barrier for me that now I didn't have to worry about what she thought. And then my father started to fade, and so I didn't have to worry about what he thought. And the only persons left that I had to worry about were my adopted sister and my brother. And, you know, the barrier was removed, and once the barrier was removed, then I think the motivation surfaced. Right?
But speaking of which, what has been the response to your memoir by your family and community?
Well, I mean, the Vietnamese community, half of them hates me already, you know, so this is more fuel for the fire. I did this event a few days ago, and this young Vietnamese American woman comes up to me and she says, "You are the second most hated person in my house."
Who's the first?
Biden, you know. Yeah, and that's not an uncommon sentiment. I have an undergraduate research assistant, she's Vietnamese, and she said, "Yeah, that's true. If my parents knew that I was working for you, which they don't, they would hate you too, you know." My own students, Vietnamese American students, tell me, "My parents think you're a commie. I'm going to take your class anyway. I just want you to know." And so, I don't really care what the community thinks. And that's important. You know, I think that's important. Because again, if you come from a community, whatever that is, it could be your family, it could be the so-called ethnic community, whatever, and you're writing stories about this community, there's oftentimes a huge barrier because you're worried, what would the community think? Mm-hmm. What if I betray their secrets? What if I don't show them in the best light, et cetera? Well, screw that. You know, I mean, like, no, it's really screw that. I mean, I know that these are valid concerns, but, you know, as a writer, I feel my obligation is to the truth and to the art and all of that. And if I'm faithful to the truth and to the art, then in fact, that's better for the so-called community than if I was just to try to paint them in the best possible light. And in fact, you know, one of the points that this book makes is, you know, white writers and artists, or maybe specifically white men, don't care. I mean, you read Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad is writing terrible stuff about white guys doing terrible things. And he produced, arguably, great art. I agree. Francis Ford Coppola did Apocalypse Now, partly based on Heart of Darkness. Problematic, true, but still great art. And so why is it that if you're a part of the dominant society, you have absolute freedom and license to say terrible things about your own people, and everybody will say, that's just art. But if you come from a so-called minority and you do the same thing, it's like, oh my God, don't betray the community. And so we of a so-called community have to be able to get over that problem if we want to make great art, in my opinion. And so what was the other part of the question? I don't remember.
Your family.
Yeah, my family. You know, my adopted sister, that's a much more complicated story. I think that, and I talk about her in this book, and we're Facebook friends, and she's beautiful. I know she's adopted because she likes to have fun, you know. And you know, my family does not know how to have fun. We're devout Catholics. And yeah, that's why I became a writer. That's my idea of fun, is to be a masochist as a writer. And her idea of fun is like to take a Facebook picture every day in a different outfit in some great location. And I love that. But you know, my books are not, most of them are not allowed to be translated into Vietnamese. So I don't even know how to give them to her. And it's, my Vietnamese is not good enough to translate this book myself for her. Right? So there will be an accounting later on. And I don't know what that will be like, because in fact, there are things I say about my Vietnamese family in Vietnam that some people may be upset about. I also say things about the Vietnamese government that I know they will be upset about, because I quote Vietnamese government documents to me saying, why is it that we are not allowed to shoot the Sympathizer TV series in Vietnam? You know, and so, I mean, I talk about that in this book. But my brother, when I finished writing this book, I hadn't told him I was writing a memoir, and I said, look, I want you to know before this is published that I wrote this book and you're in it. And he said, okay. So I said, can I send it to you? He said, okay. So I sent it to him. I didn't hear anything from him. And then my sister-in-law says, we meet, and you know, she, at a family event, and she says, you know, why won't your brother read your book? And I said, I don't know. And she said, don't you think that's weird? And I said, I don't know. And then she goes back to him and she makes him read the book, I think. And that's how we communicate, is through our wives. And dysfunctional. But he's a great brother. And he read the book, and then he said, you got it right. And then he read the published book, and he said, it's you can see his comment on Facebook, unless he deleted it. It is a good rendition of our family's lives. But my confession is that honestly, even if I already made up my mind, even before I sent him the manuscript, I was like, even if he didn't approve, I would still publish the book.
Yeah. I mean, that nicely underlines that individual authenticity is more important than collective authenticity sometimes. But to this point, too, I mean, what did you say on CBS that got cut?
Yeah, so like Friday morning started off great. I went to do CBS Mornings live interview with Vlad Duthier. He's a great guy. All the hosts were great. And this is not an empty compliment, because I've done a lot of interviews with some famous interviewers, and not all of them are great. And these people were great. And but, you know, Vlad interviewed me, and it was a great interview. And then the last question in his interview was, so I know you like Philip Roth and Portnoy's Complaint. Why? And I was like, okay, I'm happy to talk about it, but there's only one reason to talk about Portnoy's Complaint relative to me. How many people have read Portnoy's Complaint? Oh, you're missing out, those of you who haven't read it. But, you know, and the answer I gave on CBS Live, which aired, because if you were watching it live, you heard this answer. I said, you know, when I was growing up in San Jose, California, and going to this library, I was reading inappropriate things, including Portnoy's Complaint. And it's about Alex Portnoy, a young, horny, adolescent Jewish boy, and he's so horny he just masturbates with everything. And at that point I paused and I said, can I talk about this? and he smiled at me and said, sure. I said, okay. And so, and then, you know he masturbates with everything, including a slab of liver from the family fridge. And I said, gross, who eats liver, you know? And then he masturbates with the liver, and then he puts it back in the fridge, and then the family eats it for dinner later that night. And then I say, I pay homage to that in The Sympathizer. So if you haven't read The Sympathizer, then you don't know what you're missing. But anyway, so they, you know, for later time zones and everything, and for their online versions, that last question is deleted. So yeah, that's it. I've been censored.
Well, when do you write away from teaching? And what are the nuts and bolts of your writing practice?
Yeah, I just write whenever I can. So, you know, for the long, long period of the 20 years of misery that overlapped with me being a professor, it was just when on the weekends, when I wasn't grading, during the summers and so on. And there is no real secret to the nuts and bolts of my technique. I really do believe that the only things that you require to be a writer, you can do lots of other stuff, like take classes and whatever. But the only two things that are required to be a writer, and if you don't do these, you will never be a writer, you have to read a lot, widely and deeply, and you have to write a lot. Pick a figure. I pick 10,000 hours. And it doesn't matter whether you do the 10,000 hours in 10 years or you do it in 50 years. you have to do the 10,000 hours. Now, there may be like one or two of you out there who literally could do this in 1,000 hours, and you could publish your first book when you're 25. And if that's true, I hate you.
I hate you too.
Everybody hates you. Honestly, everybody hates you. But for most of us, I think it's many thousands of hours. And so I think the encouraging thing here, you know, sometimes writers will say, I write every day. Well, good for you. You know, many of us don't have the time to do that. And it's okay. You just have to do the hours eventually. If you can do that, you can be a writer. I'm not promising that you'll be a published writer, even a good writer, but you will be a writer.
So we only have time for one more question, but it's a good one. How do you exist / survive now that everyone is a potential mirror of the truth / the betrayal?
Wow, what a interesting question.
Why
is everyone a mirror, though?
Let me just ask it again. How do you exist / survive now that everyone is a potential mirror of the truth / the betrayal?
Wow, that's profound. Well, you know, it goes back to that question of being the spy, right? And as writers, well, if you're a spy, you're always spying. And, you know, part of the great thing about spy novels, why I really like the genre, is not only that it's good, it's entertaining to read and so on, but in the hands of a really good writer, a spy novel is exactly about that. The spy is investigating himself or herself or themselves, and they're also investigating everyone they encounter. So in fact, everything is mirrors and betrayals and truths. And that's the complexity of the spy story. It's not just about uncovering political secrets and all of that. It's about uncovering the depth of betrayals within all of us.
Yeah.
And so, yes, as a writer, I'm always looking at people. And in that sense, every encounter when I'm in a conversation with someone is me contemplating who they are, what they are revealing to me, even in a snippet of conversation, even in the signing line, for example, and me thinking about them, but also thinking about them in relationship to me and what they might reveal about me.
Yeah,
and
we can also betray ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we as writers, or at least me, you know, I talk about this a lot, wearing masks, putting up fronts, having pretenses, and never knowing quite exactly is the reality and the pretense of my own self and yourself.
Well, Vit, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was a great
thank you so much. Thanks to everybody out there.
Thank you all for coming.
Thanks to the American Writers Museum.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.